Hi, everyone. I'm Mark Savatelli, podcast host and president and CEO at NAIOP. You're listening to the NAIOP podcast, Inside CRE, featuring interviews with commercial real estate leaders who share industry and career insights. NAIOP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, is the development industry's leading source for education, advocacy, and connections that drive your business forward. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Rebecca Rocky. Rebecca is the Deputy Chief Economist and Global Head of Forecasting at Cushman & Wakefield, where her focus spans on economics, demographics, financial markets, and commercial real estate. Rebecca recently gave the keynote at the Chapter Leadership and Legislative Retreat here in DC just last week. Rebecca, welcome back to the podcast. And let me say, welcome back again, because you are actually the first person to be featured on both seasons of Inside CRE. So we are absolutely thrilled to have you back.
Well, thank you for inviting me back, and it's a pleasure to be here.
So when we spoke on this podcast a year ago, so much has changed, I think, since the two of us got together, but a lot has remained unchanged and unclear. I mean, it's sort of like we've come into the fog, but we've come out of the fog. And I say this all in relation to the state of the economy. Catch us up. Where are we now to, you know, when we spoke last year?
Yeah, well, you know, last year, coming into the year, there was a lot of concern around the economy, the outlook. The consensus was really forming around a modest recession on the back of the Fed's rate hike cycle that it went through. And, you know, as 2023 unfolded, I think we had a few surprises about the resilience of the economy, which we can talk more about. And as we head into this year, of course, I think there are some similarities in the sense the consensus is still expecting a downshift in economic performance after we saw a surprisingly resilient 2023. So that kind of sense of things are going to downshift is similar. What we're also seeing is this growing consensus around a soft landing, which when you start to see a consensus form, you always want to think, what are we missing? Is that, you know, really where things are headed? And I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But, you know, unlike last year, there is not this view that a recession is on the horizon for the most part, again, with the consensus being the benchmark there.
Yeah, I mean, it does, you know, if I recall correctly, it certainly seemed like we came into 2023 and all everybody kept talking about was the longest discussed recession. And then it became the longest discussed recession that never happened. And now we see a lot of this conversation about a soft landing. So what do you think? Do you think this is going to stick?
You know, I want to say I hope so. One of the things, you know, I would say there were a few things that surprised last year. One were there were a few forms of tax expenditures that had greater uptake than what was expected. So we sort of had this underpinning of fiscal policy still supporting the economy, despite that there wasn't an actual fiscal stimulus bill passed. So we had this kind of tax credit money flowing into the economy, greater expected uptake of things in, for example, the IRA or the employee retention tax credit and so on. So you had this unexpected support there. And then I think it was early in Q3, you know, can't quite exactly remember the exact month that this came out, but we found out from the Bureau of Economic Analysis that the amount of excess savings held by consumers was significantly greater than what we had thought coming into 2023. So there were reasons, I think, that are very legitimate about why some of that resilience happened, why some of that outperformance happened. And of course, probably you've seen some stats around Q3 GDP last year being buttressed by things like Beyonce and Taylor Swift and Barbie and all those things. And those were, you know, sort of one-off pushes in that Q3 GDP number last year. As we head into this year, I think things are going to downshift. Our view is that things are going to downshift. We're seeing pockets of the economy that are under significant pressure and, in fact, in their own sort of mini recession. And in this way, you'll hear us as well as others who are kind of looking at the world this way describe this as a rolling recession. Parts of the economy are not necessarily having, you know, the kind of resilience of the macro GDP numbers. Certainly CRE is in a volumes recession, whether it's leasing, capital markets. We're seeing this in freight and transportation more broadly outside of airlines. So airlines are the one kind of bright spot there. We're seeing it in even warehouse jobs, right? We've been losing warehouse jobs for the better part of 2023. We lost over 400,000 temp jobs, which are a subset of office, which actually led office to go on a multi-month streak of losses until the January jobs report this year. So what we saw over the course of last year was fewer and fewer sectors contributing to that growth. That they were typically lagging sectors in the economy, things like government, education, healthcare, which have a sort of stickiness to the way they respond to higher rates. And as we move through this year, I think we have to appreciate that we're still adjusting across the economy to higher rates. And no, there's no guarantee that we get that soft landing, although that is a growing consensus. You know, we certainly want to be sensitive to incoming data. The fact that Powell took March off the table, I think, with the combined with some hot data recently, I think it's going to make the next meeting very important in terms of forward guidance. And so we're sort of cautiously optimistic that there will be pockets of growth. There are going to be markets that are chugging along no problem this year. But I think it's going to be more bifurcated. It's not going to be rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah. And you know, there's a lot to unpack there. And I think it goes to a lot about what you're seeing overall, I think, in the mood of the country. You know, there was actually a piece in the Wall Street Journal that just talked about, you know, the economy seems to be doing well. But if you ask the public about it, they'd give you a very different answer about that. And that seems to be a lot about what you were just highlighting there. So what do you think is really driving that? You know, if you, to a layperson, you know, can you talk a little bit about this, you know, economic performance data against what that public perception is?
Yeah, I think if you told the public we had a really strong GDP year, we added millions of jobs, they're not going to feel like that's necessarily consistent with their experience. And I think that's been dubbed sort of this, you know, vibe session, if you will. And I think that really comes from the fact that people hate inflation. And while the pace of inflation has slowed materially, we're now in this sort of bumpy path back to 2, and it's not going to be every month as an improvement, as we just saw in the latest data, we're still dealing with prices that are materially higher than they were before the pandemic. And I think there's also a sort of catch-up that's going on because it was really only in the course of last year, and not even the entire year last year, where incomes actually started to grow on a real basis again. And so that purchasing power, while it's improving from the heyday of inflation, it's still under pressure, right? Households still feel like they don't get the same bang for their buck. And inflation affects everyone. You know, that is something that needs to be appreciated. You'll hear a kind of description of unemployment only affects a few people, but inflation does affect everyone. And the lower income that a household is, the more pressure that's creating as some of those big ticket items like shelter or transportation or food, those prices are very high and they're continuing to increase. I think food inflation was 0.4% month over month in the latest inflation report. So I think that's what's going on in terms of the sentiment and the so-called vibe session.
So talking about that sentiment and vibe session, let's vibe session here for a minute on commercial real estate. Kind of take what you just talked about it and, you know, look at that macro data and say, well, how does this impact commercial real estate? What's the vibe, so to speak, on that?
Yeah, well, I think as we, well, first, when we looked at last year, big picture, things were happening, how it affected real estate came down to the underlying things below GDP, right? And what was going on with rates. And so I'm very proud to say our forecasts were extremely accurate on the real estate side last year, and we're feeling really confident about our expectations for this year. And in some ways, we think this year is going to look just a lot like last year. Mm-hmm. We're going to be in a rate environment that is high. We're going to be in a growth environment that's decelerating from the pandemic growth rates that we observed in 21 and 22. And we're seeing normalization across different property markets, particularly think about things like industrial and multifamily, which were very heated. I think this year, though, what's different from last year on the annual basis is going to be it's more a tale of two halves, we think. So first half of the year, we're still in this rate environment where the Fed is saying, look, we are going to cut. We still need some additional data. The moment that we actually get that pivot, we think that's going to set off a sort of series of events that lead to more velocity in the market, more conviction around the rate outlook and how that is going to trickle through into the real economy and into property markets and capital markets especially. So, you know, on the whole, if you just took annual data, we think some of the numbers are going to look pretty similar. And then when you kind of think about, well, what's under the hood there, it's really first half of the year, probably more subdued. Second half of the year, we think we're going to see more velocity. We think we're going to see more transactions and more discovery on pricing and therefore an acceleration in activity.
Yeah, you just anticipated my follow-up question. It perhaps, you know, we're reaching that period of price discovery there. So that is interesting to hear. I want to switch gears here for a minute. You know, as I mentioned at the outset, and our listeners, you know, you spoke at our recent chapter leadership and legislative retreat, and you spent time highlighting, you know, the topics that you expect to dominate the economic conversation in the next year or so. So for those that weren't able to join us in DC, I'd like to just take a few minutes to cover some of those. So one of the first things that you discussed was the national debt. It continues to rise, yet we've got a host of expiring tax cuts coming up, tax cuts that don't seem yet be getting a lot of press. What do you think that this means for the economy as a whole?
Well, I think the longer that you go without addressing these mounting issues, it's going to create costs down the line that are more and more significant. You know, this is going to be the first year where the cost of interest on the debt exceeds the defense budget, the Medicare budget, and, you know, the amount of debt that continues to roll over at higher prices, right? Again, it's not just a maturity wall in CRE. It's corporates, financial corporates, non-financial corporates, and it's also the U.S. government. And this is really going to put pressure, I think, on lawmakers to really consider how we approach things that add to the deficit that don't follow the rules of PAYGO, as it's called, which is just a requirement that you pay for things as you go in Congress. And the tax cuts, even when they were initially passed, was an example of something that was not fully funded. Yeah. And not all bills are. There have been things under Biden that were not fully funded. I think it depends on really what happens with the congressional elections this fall, but you are probably going to have more scrutiny on spending. There's only so much you can do with discretionary. I think I mentioned on stage that if you were to pass and just continue with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and just extend it another 10 years, that's going to cost $3.8 trillion, including the cost of interest on the debt needed to support that. And that's greater than the whole discretionary budget as it is. So tough choices will need to be made about if and what we do keep, and how that decision process plays out will affect clearly the economy on the margin and in a sort of near-term way, as well as decisions around maybe even things in the CRE sector. It also may depend on what happens. If you have a split Congress, I think that's very likely going to be a choppier conversation than if you get, for example, a unified Congress and presidency. You're probably going to have more decisive action one way or the other.
When you were addressing the crowd too, we talked a little bit about adaptive reuse. You know, this is an important topic to NAIOP and to a lot of our members. you know, where are you seeing the most interest in adaptive reuse, and where are you seeing the most success with that as well?
Yeah, I think, well, I would kind of frame it a few ways. We're tracking about 45 markets across North America, because although other regions of the world have very different backdrops for their office market, both the US and Canada are facing similar challenges with the office sector in particular. And so I think I would say we're in very early stages of what is likely to continue to be a key trend for the foreseeable future. I would say years, not even just the next year or two. And in the markets where we're tracking detailed data, what we're finding is that clearly the number one thing that investors are doing or owners are doing is conversions to apartments. And this is, I think, the default expectation. You hear a lot about it in the press, and we're tracking somewhere just under 100 projects in those markets that we're tracking. And the square footage is not immaterial, right? We're talking just under 30 million square feet in those markets themselves. And as those conversions happen, I think the beauty for offices, you take really weak properties out of the market. And that not only affects the inventory, it also affects the level of vacancy in the market. What I find to be very interesting, though, and I think is reflective of just how challenging and costly it is to convert an office building to apartment, it doesn't always quite work, is that the next three most common things we're tracking are actually owners reinvesting in their office assets, whether it's a complete repositioning, which we track as its own category. That's the second most common thing, with conversions being the first. The third most common thing are upgrading the lobby, and the fourth most common thing, upgrading other kinds of amenities in a building. Yeah. So there are many instances where owners are doubling down actually on office and saying, you know, at some point that top echelon of office product is going to be fully leased and I want to be next in line. And we're seeing that in the actual data as it comes in.
Which is good to see. And we're going to get to that in a few minutes, because I think you can listen to a lot of press, you can read a lot of press, watch it, and that story just does not come out. It always seems to be quite the opposite. Like, everybody's running around just waiting for the other shoe to drop wherever you go in the press. So very good to hear that that's what your data is starting to show. I want to talk about a little bit of a different issue, probably not the sexiest issue. One of the things that NAIOP has been working on this year is on capital and credit. And for anybody, at least in the DC area, we actually saw an ad during the Super Bowl dealing with Basel III. And, you know, this is really all about banks and the access to credit, because this is an ongoing concern for developers, owners, investors. What is Basel III, and what are some of the key things to watch in commercial real estate sector on this?
Yeah, I think for the audience, you know, the main thing about Basel is that it was formed after the GFC among countries all over the world, right? And so there's a sort of global effort to create some kind of framework that's consistent across boundaries. Of course, in the US, we also had Dodd-Frank, but that affected our banks and not others. And so the effort to increase capital across the bank sector globally is sort of ultimately what Basel III is aiming to do. And the size of the bank clearly is going to affect the magnitude of the potential change that could happen to a given bank. And so just to give some sense of, you know, what that impact could be, when you're looking at larger banks, so kind of think banks with $100 billion or more in assets, the level of capital, so the level of dollars of capital would, under Basel III, as currently proposed, would go up by anywhere from 15 to 20%. And that's, there's a range because there are lots of different groups that create estimates, but that's sort of the range of estimates. And then as you get into under $100 billion, now you're looking at ranges more in that kind of high single digits, right? So under 10% increase in capital, but still not as significant as the largest banks. And, you know, this is the challenge, is that anytime you're putting more capital aside, it's not going to other uses. And I think that's where there are some risks for any sector that depends on the banks for financing. It could increase the cost of capital at a time when it's already challenging. It's a challenging time in terms of liquidity. Banks are still tightening their lending standards. So, you know, they're not tightening as quickly as they were, especially during the initial stages of the rate hiking cycle, let alone when SVB ran into issues last spring. But they're still tightening. And then you're going to add on this change at a time when really we're already seeing a lot of constraints on the sector. So, you know, that's kind of the description of it that I would give. There's sort of a nickname that's been given, an end game, because of potentially how some view it as very, very stringent. You know, I think the good news here, I'll just mention this quickly, is there does seem to be a consensus of pushback against it as currently written, including, as I mentioned in my remarks, by the House Financial Services Committee. And when you get a bipartisan statement from the House, which is very polarized, I think that tells you something. And it does mean there's going to be ongoing feedback and ongoing amendments to the current sort of framework that's in place in the current law, so that some of the feedback is brought in and there are some improvements made.
Seems odd to hear that there's an issue where we could actually have bipartisan agreement on something there. So, you know, look, that is a bit of an ominous cloud that's out there. But, you know, is there any prediction about when capital may actually become more readily available for commercial real estate? Is it on the horizon at all?
I think so. I think look no further than the dry powder data, right? I do think being in the early stages of a credit cycle and with particular scrutiny, even outside of Basel III, on banks, looking to banks to be the first in a shifting market as we head into the second half of the year. I don't know so much about that. Yeah. Selectively, yes, I do think they'll be in the market. I'm looking more towards other sources of capital, thinking in private credit, equity, debt funds, stepping in and taking advantage of attractive pricing, the ability to kind of gain some market share, and in a world where, again, we're hopefully on the back end of rate increases and on our way down. So we think second half of this year, we're going to start to see some acceleration in that, again, tied to this view that we think we'll be on the downside here with the rate outlook.
Let's take a quick look on the viewing near term. What do you see in terms of property values in the near term?
Well, you know, I think it's a good question, because what's interesting about property prices is, you know, you can look at REITs in real time and kind of get a sense of where pricing is at in that world. All of the measures typically on the private side lag. You know, they measure a specific thing. And what we know in times of dislocation, like the one we've been in, is that the share of transactions that are reporting cap rates goes down a lot. You know, you're lucky if you're even getting a big enough sample size where you have reported cap rates. So what you also want to think about is, what is the market shadow price that would actually facilitate a transaction absent even those transactions taking place? And that's really the true price of the market, right? And in that way, we think we're actually very much near bottom, that we've made a lot of the decline in prices, although they're slowly materializing in the ways that we measure private pricing, that a lot of that has taken place. And that as we head through the first half of the year, we have a little bit more to go. And in the second half of this year, we think we'll kind of be stabilizing at bottom. And that's going to help facilitate that recovery and activity. And from there, it's really just a matter of recovery in pricing and early stages of price recovery as we head through 2025.
So with that in mind, looking at a bit more of a long-term now investment for commercial real estate, any concerns about that? Or do you think there's some opportunity here looking a little bit longer term beyond what we were just discussing?
Oh, yeah. So I think at the end of the day, commercial real estate is a very attractive asset class. And I don't just say that without data to back me up. What we do is we look at 10-year return horizons, both historically and forecast over the next 10 years, and we compare it to other asset classes. We compare it to whether it's sovereign bonds, corporate bonds, equities, commodities, so kind of think gold, right? Think about oil. And then we also look at inflation. Is it going to beat inflation over that time? And CRE has historically outperformed on a total return basis, and it's looking like that will be the case. And that's including, by the way, some pretty significant declines in values that we have had over the course of the last 12 to 18 months. And as we head through the middle of this year, and even with those baked in, we're looking at a very attractive total return profile. Now, I think in the immediate term, we definitely are looking at the fact that these are real assets, they're income producing, and that income return is going to be, I think, of incredible focus in the near term. As we head out further, right, we'll start to be able to see cap rate compression, value appreciation, and so on, sort of add the additional tailwinds. But if you think about the next 12 months, we're really also focused on what is that income side going to do, especially because most fundamentals outside of office, especially, are quite strong, right? They're normalizing, but they're actually pretty robust.
Yeah, I think particularly in the industrial market, while it has slowed down, I think most industrial developers, if you asked them 10 years ago for this type of rate, they would be pretty happy with where the market is at.
Yeah, I mean, I look back to our forecasts, you know, for last year and where we ended up, and it was a lower than normal demand year in terms of absorption, and we're expecting that again this year, but vacancy is still historically low, you know, and I think that broader horizon, that longer perspective needs to be taken because it really is a case of normalization, and it's still a tight market in most cities around the country.
Well, speaking of absorption and future demand, what do you anticipate, you know, all that? Are you seeing any trends or what you think might happen in the next 12 to 24 months in that regard?
With industrial?
Let's take a look at it maybe as commercial real estate as a whole, and then maybe as a follow-up, is there a particular asset class which you think might be the most resilient within commercial real estate?
Yeah, I think both multi and industrial have a similar theme in the sense we think that they're going to have fairly positive levels of demand. So for industrial, it will be below average this year and the first part of next year. But again, it's really a supply-driven story with respect to what's happening to vacancy, historically tight vacancy rates, and we're still expecting rent growth in the aggregate in most markets. So pretty positive there. I think multifamily, again, it's also a supply story. Here, we're expecting fairly robust levels of demand. It's just that even relative to industrial, that supply-demand imbalance is a little greater in the near term. So we're going to see that push on vacancy to a greater extent than in industrial, but we expect that to be fairly short-lived. And so after this supply wave sort of comes to the market over the course of the next 18 months, there's very little behind it, and we're structurally underbuilt in housing. And so we think that there's a very strong recovery for vacancy specifically, because all along we're expecting demand for multifamily to remain pretty strong. It's just renters are going to have a whole lot of options out there. Retail has been, just like the economy, incredibly resilient. We are at a 40-year low in the vacancy rate right now. Rents are appreciating at a very robust pace. And, you know, here's where things underneath the hood of GDP become important, because consumers, there's pent-up demand for services. Even still, we're below where we would have been on a trend basis before COVID. And so we know that there's a sort of normalization that's still happening. A lot of services are consumed through the retail ecosystem. And so we are looking at what we think will be a fairly resilient year. And I say that because we are expecting consumers to pull back a little bit, right? Under the pressure of inflation, slowing wage growth, slowing job growth. If the Fed is achieving what it wants to achieve, we're going to see things downshift a bit. And even with that, we're expecting retail vacancy to not move up very much. There's very little supply, and there are very few really great locations for retail available for occupiers. So I think there's a story there. We put out a series last fall highlighting that because we think it's an exciting time for retail. And then just to kind of hit on the last, I call the main food groups, office. So office is complicated. And in the aggregate, you know, we're still expecting a year where absorption is negative. We think we still have maybe 150 basis points or so to go on vacancy in terms of upward movement. We're at 19.7 right now. We think we kind of peak out just in that 21.5, 22 range. And we're also going to see, you know, some of the tailing off of some of the deliveries that are under construction right now coming to the market as part of that vacancy movement as well. We still are expecting negative demand this year, less negative in size than 2023 and 2020, you know, and even the first half of 2021. We think we're going to see some tailing off of the pace of negative demand. And then you can kind of get into the segmentation, right? Not all markets are equal. We see tertiary markets definitely outperforming. We see some large cities outperforming, like a Miami. And then you do have other cities that are much more challenged, some that aren't always intuitive. And then you kind of also have the segmentation by asset quality. And even here, things can get complicated because we know top tier product, and just think about that as maybe the top 10 to 15% of the office market in any given city. We know that that's outperforming, right? And by a host of metrics, I think we've all kind of come to understand that. It's sort of what's next and what's going on in any given city where this things get a little bit more complicated. So I would use maybe a few examples, right? I'm sitting in New York right now for this recording. We know that the location and the proximity to transit really matters. So even if you're not top tier, if you're good enough and you're in a great location, you're seeing some premiums in terms of leasing velocity, occupancy, stability, and so on. In some other markets, it might be more tied to the specific companies and tenants that are in a given building as to whether or not it performs. In some cities, we know that suburban office is really where things have been at before COVID, and that's still true. Think of a San Diego. Suburbs are really the lifeblood of the office market and where there's a lot of activity. And the CBD has kind of always had a higher vacancy and a higher challenging situation. And then you could juxtapose that with something like a Tampa, where it's the total opposite. The suburbs are challenged, but the CBD is sort of thriving and we're seeing more activity there. So this is where I think it starts to become nuanced in a way that, if you like to nerd out, is really exciting. But it's hard to paint with a broad brush, although I'm sure, like me, you've observed the media certainly tries to do that with respect to office. And it's just, unfortunately, a lazy way of thinking about the sector.
Couldn't agree with you more. You know, we seem to be banging that drum constantly here. You know, that painting that broad brush is just beyond incorrect, and really kind of misses the story unless there's a narrative that you're trying to tell. I want to switch to a little bit of a different trend here for a moment. One of the things that we're seeing here at NAIOP, probably one of the bigger areas of interest, deals with, you know, the manufacturing boom, the reshoring. Is this showing up in your data? Are you starting to see this as well too? And what's the forecast for this trend?
Yeah, I mean, so we're seeing it in our data. We're seeing it in government data. There's very clearly a boom that's happening. Now, I think I'll start with maybe citing some government data, and then I will come back into what we're seeing in the CRE kind of, you know, the square footage and the kinds of trends that we're seeing there. You can look at data from the Census Bureau. It's the value of real estate under construction by different type of construction. And when you look at that, you see manufacturing construction is up a lot. Now, that data are not inflation adjusted. So once you do that, you see basically the amount of space has doubled. Now, that's looking at the dollar value. And I think that's important to note because manufacturing is very expensive to build. So we know the number of dollars going into the investment of the construction of these buildings has doubled. What we also know is that basically the entirety of that increase has been driven by one subpart of manufacturing, which in the data are electrical manufacturing and so on. That's basically where batteries and semiconductors and all of those kinds of things you hear as buzzword, that's where that lives in the data. So it's those sectors that are driving this. And I point that out because those sectors currently account for only 1.2% of manufacturing output in this country. So you'll hear people say there's a manufacturing recession. The ISM manufacturing index has been in recession territory for, you know, I don't even know at this point, maybe over 12 months, 13 months. And how can these two things be true at the same time? And it's really, we're booming in certain areas of manufacturing and there are long-term investments being made. We are seeing those investments grow the fastest in the mountain region, in the West more generally, in the South Atlantic region. Where we're seeing the least acceleration is sort of the Middle Atlantic Northeast. So there are regional winners and there are, I don't want to call them regional losers, but there are those that are not getting to be as much of a winner in this situation. And that's just looking at, you know, government data. This anybody can go do that. What we did is we went in and we looked at what's actually happening with the square footage. And it has not quite doubled the manufacturing space under construction. And what we also found is that a lot of the increase has been driven by owner users. And the reason that that's an important distinction is it just those are companies that build the space, occupy it themselves. It does not necessarily create opportunities to transact a lease on a given property and so on. Mm-hmm. It doesn't but you know, at the end of the day, these are still facilities that are bringing jobs, skilled jobs, two different regions, and down the line, those have multiplier benefits for the economy. And of course, as a country, through the kinds of legislation that are supporting these, it's clearly been dubbed their benefits to national security and supply chain resilience as well. So, you know, that's what we're seeing, a little less increase compared to the doubling in dollar terms, in terms of square footage, and driven a lot by owner users with the West region and the South Atlantic really being kind of the key beneficiaries so far with the fastest growth. I don't want to understate though, the Midwest is seeing a lot of increase as well.
Well, that's good. Yeah, because we don't want to have any losers here in this debate.
No losers.
So we spoke after, you know, your presentation at the chapter leadership retreat. And you know, you mentioned that you were going to be moderating a session the next day at the National Association for Business Economics, focused on the urban doom loop. So I've got to ask about this because we've talked about this in terms of the press. You know, it seemed as we were talking that you thought that the panel of economists were going to kind of strike a more of an optimistic tone on the office market and indicated that fears might be too extreme. Is this what you heard? Do you agree with that? What came out of this?
Yeah, it was a great panel. Three really esteemed panelists joined me, Chris DeRides of Moody's Analytics, Aaron Klein of the Brookings Institute, and Aaron Patterson of Manulife. And the takeaway was, look, in the aggregate, from a macroeconomic perspective, the threat of a doom loop, however you want to define that, because there are kind of different ways you can think about a doom loop, that the risk of that materializing is low. And there were a lot of reasons for that, not limited to the fact that the investor community is very diverse in commercial real estate. So the risks are very diffuse, right? You have a ton of heterogeneity in terms of what commercial real estate is. One of the panelists even was talking about the fact that, you know, everything from churches to warehouses to hotels to life sciences, all of that is bucketed into commercial real estate from a regulator point of view. And, you know, again, for most properties, fundamentals look pretty good. There is still, I think, an acknowledgement that some cities are going to be more challenged than others. So it's not to downplay that there aren't some significant things that cities face around the country, but it is to say that in the aggregate, if we're expecting some kind of doom loop to trigger a recession or something like that, the panelists did seem to agree, you know, that that fear is overblown and that that is really more of a tail end risk, not a base case.
Well, I got to admit, I'm glad that we're going to end here with just a couple of quick questions, but on so much more of an optimistic note. So just a couple of quick questions here as we wrap it up. You know, what should we be paying attention to in the economic data in, you know, in that's coming out in the near future? Is there something that you say to any commercial real estate developer? If you're going to look at anything, this is it.
Yeah, I mean, it might be cliche, but the Fed has a dual mandate. One is employment and one is inflation. So that job report every month, watch it. The inflation reports, you know, and there are different ones, CPI, PPI, PCE. Watch the inflation data, period. If you're looking for a weekly indicator, Thursday morning, 8:30 a.m., initial claims come out. That's going to be your most real-time barometer on the labor market if you don't want to wait till the BLS puts out the job report. So those are going to be the things that I would say to watch, because that's going to play into the way that a data-dependent Fed evolves its guidance. And so those are going to be things I think that just dominate. It's a little cliche, but that's where we are in the cycle.
Outstanding. So are there any resources that you would suggest for our listeners to maybe take a look at outside of taking a look at some of those key metrics?
Yeah, well, I think I'm a big blog person and I'm a big podcast person. So it depends on how you want to consume your information. I listen to NAOP's podcast. There's a great podcast every week that Moody's Analytics does. They go through economic data. They talk about it in layman's terms. So if you're not an economist, you're going to enjoy it.
And they bring out, just going to ask that.
Yeah, guest speakers from different industries. So you can get a lens into what's going on here or there. So I think those kinds of things, you know, and I have a whole list of podcasts I could give, but that's a great way. And that's what how I prefer to consume information. And then you have blogs, you know, just I follow Calculated Risk. Bill McBride does this blog. And what I love about it is he just does a quick summary of all the data releases that are coming out. So, and again, in layman's terms, and he puts in bold right there for you, what's the key takeaway from that data release? And you can kind of pick and choose what you care about. But I think it's a nice one-stop shop if you're looking for somewhere to go for intel on how data's evolving.
That's great. It's a lot of resources and it was a lot of information. It was so great, Rebecca, to have you join us again here on our podcast. Truly enjoyed our conversation. I have no doubt that our listeners enjoyed it. It was a well-received podcast the last time we had you. And I look forward to seeing you again.
Yes.
Great having you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Inside CRE with your host, Mark Savatelli. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and be sure to subscribe.